This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Golden visas have lost their luster. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. A visa scheme introduced in 2008 has encouraged wealthy people outside the European Union to invest in the UK. In return, it offers the chance at residency here in Britain. How quickly depends on how much you're willing to invest, though. $2.7 million allows a residency application within 5 years. That timeline shrinks to 2 years if the investment totals about $13 million. The scheme has come under scrutiny before amid concerns it's open to abuse, but next week the government in London is expected to scrap it all together amid pressure for the UK to cut ties with Russia as the Ukraine crisis deepens. The BBC's Adam Fleming explains why the UK is an attractive destination for wealthy Russians.
There's a few reasons for that. There's quite a big Russian community here already. There's something particularly attractive, it seems, about UK real estate, both as a thing to live in and as an investment to have. British private schools are very popular with Russians. And I'm sure if you were to speak to a tax lawyer who's more of an expert, maybe there would be certain tax advantages for being located in the UK as well. It just seems like a pretty popular place for wealthy Russians to come.
So just explain, what are golden visas and who gets them and how often are they issued?
They're technically called Tier 1 high-value investor visas. And they are for people who want to come to the UK who have at least £2 million to invest in the British economy.
That's about $2.7 million.
And they then get the right to live in the UK for a few years. And the number of them issued every year varies from year to year. Looking at the latest statistics up to 2020, it looks like there was about 5,000 of them, and it sort of hovers around that mark over the years. But they're going to exist no longer.
And why has the UK decided to crack down on them now?
So there has actually been quite a long-term transition to a new immigration system in the UK where all these old tiers of visas have been gradually swept away and replaced by a points-based system where individuals' circumstances are assessed and they accumulate points. And once they get to a certain threshold, they get access to their visa. So this is one of the last kind of leftover bits of the old system. And it's been under review for a while, but it's already being interpreted as related to the situation in Ukraine, because there's a sort of feeling that lots of wealthy Russians come to the UK and that this would be a way of closing down another route for Russians to come to the UK. I think that interpretation is maybe a little bit overblown because, as I said, the Home Office, the UK's Interior Ministry, has been looking at getting rid of this last old-fashioned bit of the visa system for quite some time now.
The BBC's Adam Fleming. Thanks for breaking this down.
Thank you.
Well, investors are still laser-focused on geopolitics. As we check the numbers now, benchmarks across Europe are down slightly at this hour. That's after Ukraine and Russian-backed separatists in the Donbas region have this morning accused each other of firing across the line of contact in eastern Ukraine. Ceasefire violations are common in the region, and there are concerns any escalation could become a pretext for a wider war. Investors are seeking safety of government bonds. 10-year U.S. Treasury yields fell to 2% as prices rise. Gold is up 0.9%. Learning to live with COVID is a phrase we've been hearing a lot lately, but it's a lot easier for some than others. A study has been making the rounds from an HR group here in the UK, and it found a quarter of employers surveyed said long COVID is among the main causes of long-term sickness absences. And only 25% of companies said they were providing guidance for managers about how to support people to stay at work while they deal with ongoing health conditions. So we wondered, what kind of toll could that take on the labor market long-term? Katie Bach, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, has been looking into exactly that question.
We know that under a reasonable set of assumptions, this could have a major impact on workforce participation. We don't know how big that impact is. We don't know how long it will last. And we don't know how big of a role that is playing in some of the labor shortage issues we're seeing today. And that's why we actually need to focus on collecting better data.
And that's interesting because in your piece, you talk about that there's a difference between workers leaving the workforce altogether because of long-term illness or disability, things like long COVID, and those just dropping down to part-time.
Yeah, there have been a couple pretty good surveys of people who self-identify as having long COVID. Somewhere around a quarter of them are not working at the time of the survey due to long COVID. That doesn't mean only 25% stopped working. It could be that 100% stopped working, but only 25% were not working at the time of the survey. And I think this is one of the things that makes getting to a reliable estimate so challenging. At every step of the way, you see how the data could be biased. So by the time someone self-identifies as having long COVID and is in a support group, you might say, well, that's probably a more severe case, someone who is more likely to have stopped work. So because I did rely on those surveys to get a sense of what percentage of people had to stop working or had to go down to part-time, I made incredibly conservative assumptions everywhere else.
You looked at how questions are asked, and specifically the Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey, and you found that the way they're asking it doesn't really encompass long COVID, or if you're answering the questions, you may be confused about where exactly you fit in.
Yes, exactly. And I doubt that that was their intention. When they were designing this, it was in the earlier days, and perhaps it was before we understood what a challenge long COVID would be. But inadvertently, they ended up with a set of questions where long COVID just kind of slips through the cracks, or it could. Unfortunately, while we have this great, you know, COVID-specific survey, we can't use it to get a read on how big of an impact long COVID is having.
And that's specifically in the US, but what about other countries? I know you've looked at here in the UK. Are there differences between how the US and the UK is collecting data on this kind of stuff?
You guys are certainly doing better than we are. The Office of National Statistics is actually keeping track of lingering symptoms after a COVID infection. And so in the UK, we actually have some sense of how long people stay sick if they have lingering symptoms after a COVID infection. You guys are apparently also doing surveys of employers to understand their impression. In the US, I haven't seen anything like that.
So ultimately, what data do you think still needs to be collected? Or what kind of questions do you think we need to be asking on a national or even international level, I guess?
So in the US, in terms of the labor market impact, my recommendation is that we use the current population survey, which is, it's sort of like the source of truth on things like employment rates, unemployment, et cetera. What I would recommend is that the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics work with some of the long COVID advocacy groups to add, I don't know, three or four questions. I think the wording will be tricky because it's not clear to me that you actually want to use the phrase long COVID, or at least that you want to rely exclusively on that, because someone who is in month three of post-COVID symptoms might not associate themselves with that term. But I think these patient advocacy groups would be excellent at saying, look, like if you want to catch this group, here is how you frame the question. And I think what's really important is the questions have to be around one, just the sheer number of people who are experiencing post-COVID symptoms. Two, the percentage of those who have had to take time off work or go to part-time, so any work hours impact. Three, the percentage of those people who have managed to receive any sort of workplace accommodation. And four, the percentage of those people who have applied for and then either gotten or not gotten Social Security disability. And I think that at least would give us a fact base that we can work with.
Katie Bach from the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much for breaking this down for us.
Thanks so much.
In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.